This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Maybe you've seen the Coen brothers' 1998 film, The Big Lebowski, once or twice. Bet you liked it better the second time. Devoted fans of the film believe that the more often you view it, the more you'll become attached. The film's legion of fans meet for a yearly convention at a bowling alley in Louisville, dressed like the Dude, played, of course, by Jeff Bridges, or like Walter, played by John Goodman. Now, it may be hard to believe, but there's a 400-page scholarly book about the film. We'll talk to one of the contributors, Craig Owens of Drake University. Later in the hour, we'll hear how scholars of transportation logistics are assisting in natural disasters, such as the earthquake in Haiti. We'll talk to Ann Campbell, professor of management science at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa follows news from Iowa Public Radio and National Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. The Dude abides. In 1998, when Joel and Ethan Coen released their movie, The Big Lebowski, it drew moderate audiences and lost a little money. 12 years later, it still hasn't generated much revenue for the studio and the brothers, but the movie has built a loyal group of devoted fans. In fact, the movie may be the last decade's most venerated cult film. There's a yearly convention of Big Lebowski fans who meet at a bowling alley in Louisville, and academics love it too. For Indiana University Press has published the book, The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. One of the essayists is Drake University English professor Craig N. Owens. Craig, you have an essay in The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. What is there, about 50 essays in this book, I suppose?
That's about right, yeah.
I would imagine a lot of people are surprised to know that this book exists, an academic book on a film that's hard to describe. How would you describe the film?
Well, it seems to me that the film is, it's certainly not a celebration of academic life, that's for sure, or the rigors of employment at all. It's really a, kind of a, an homage to tuning out and to getting out of the rat race, or to getting out of the high-pressure environments of work, of economy, of money-making and spending money. So it is surprising, as you say, that a film like The Great Lebowski should have, I'm sorry, The Big Lebowski,
yeah.
I'm going to say that again. It is surprising, as you say, that a film like The Big Lebowski is attracts critical attention, especially 10 years after it was made. So I understand your sense of surprise about that.
It's funny, I often will say The Great Lebowski, too, and I'm trying to think why that is. Apparently you do that once in a while, too. It Great Gatsby, maybe, or something slipping in?
Yeah, you know, because there maybe that's it. It's also that on one of the later releases of the film, there was a satirical or a kind of spurious introduction given by a fictitious film producer and a restorer, and in it he claims to have discovered the only remaining copy of the film The Big Lebowski, but he found it in Italian, he claims, in which it was called Le Grand Lebowski. I guess I was thinking of The Grand Lebowski when I said The Great Lebowski, when in fact it's The Big Lebowski. So it seems like I was unconsciously taken in by the little joke at the beginning of the collector's release of the film.
Yeah. So many people love and adore this film, and it's you run into people, and some people you would never expect, who have seen this 10, 15, 20 times and are always happy to see it again. How many times have you seen it?
I haven't seen it 15 times. Over my life, I've probably seen it 5 or 6 times in its entirety, and then, you know, occasionally in bits and pieces when it's been on some television or somebody's VCR or DVD player, but certainly not 15 times.
When you looked the book up on a library catalog under Big Lebowski, I noticed the Library of Congress classification. The first line that comes up is slackers. / drama, and I don't see the Dude as a slacker first and foremost. Do you?
Well, I think that's where the cult appeal comes from. That is, my sense is that it's because of the sense that he doesn't take anything very seriously that people find his character so refreshing. But I don't think Slacker totally covers every aspect of his character. It seems to me that there are certain things he does take seriously. You know, he's an avid bowler. He took his rug, which tied the whole room together, and which gets stolen at the beginning of the film. Not stolen, but damaged at the very beginning of the film, very seriously. So when he gets crossed, he's willing to rise to the occasion to do what he needs to do to get, you know, get what he wants. So I'm not sure, as you said, I'm not sure Slacker entirely describes his character. I think it's probably his preferred state. It might be his default mode. If everything is, you know, is easygoing, if his landlord isn't bugging him for money, if somebody hasn't involved him in a mock kidnapping that he's basically blackmailed into taking part in solving, I think yes, he would just be a slacker. But because we see aspects of his character that allow him to take action, albeit often misguided or wrong-headed action, I would agree with you on that point.
Yeah. Joel and Ethan Coen's movie, The Big Lebowski, now we're discussing the book, The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. Craig Owens, who teaches at Drake University, has an essay in the book. When you read an academic book like this of 400 and some pages about basically a comedy, that we love the comedy, but you learn some things probably about the movie that you didn't realize even if you've seen it a dozen times. When you went through the book, Craig, what did you learn that you hadn't thought about before?
Well, one essay that I remember that jumped out at me was an essay by a scholar named Judith Roof. And I can't remember the title of the essay itself. I think it's Size Matters. I think that's what it's called.
That's right, yeah.
Professor Roof focuses on the way liquids get used in the film. And it's a very funny and insightful essay. And suddenly, when you start reading the piece and you start seeing all the places where fluid exchange takes place in the film, you realize, oh, it is a very... it's a very wet film in some ways. It's a very in some ways, a disgusting film in ways that you might not have initially perceived. So I think that's the value of the essays like that, is that they draw your attention to a detail or a facet of the film that you might have overlooked. And it's not that they're making outrageous interpretive claims, but rather that they're just trying to really focus in on details and ask, what does it mean that these details recur, you know, in these patterns throughout the film. And so I think that's what I take from these essays, is the ability to kind of focus in or hone in on significant or interesting details that are easy to overlook if you're watching the film as a whole.
Yes, and I've had people say that every time they watch it again, they pick up a number of things that they missed the first time, and I think that is the case. There's a lot of layers in this film, and a lot of the essays in the book seem to revolve around castration.
Yeah, it does. I mean, what you say about the film, I think, is exactly right, and it's this, that the film repays watching it, and it reveals more of its layers of meaning or interpretive possibilities the more you watch it. So it's a film that, in some ways, teaches you how to watch it the more you watch it, and it's a film that, in some ways, rewards you for doing so. So as, for instance, to the castration anxiety that seems to pervade the film, or the hints of castration anxiety, you know, I guess Freud would say, well, sometimes a pair of scissors is just a pair of scissors. But when you've got somebody like Jeff Bridges running away from them after having had some kind of ferocious rodent thrown in his bathtub between his legs, it's hard not, after a couple of watchings, to start putting these details together and saying, oh, wait a minute, there's something significant about the pattern that these details are creating. I think that's exactly how this film works. And that's, again, I guess I would go back and say that's why, another reason why Slacker may not be the all-encompassing term for what the film is about or the kind of people who watch it, because there is a little bit of work involved in watching this film. I mean, people who are really into this film have it all memorized.
Yes, indeed.
And they can recite the lines back and forth, and they have a great deal of fun doing it, and they have really put a lot of effort into their film watching. And I know that it's easy to laugh at putting effort into film watching, but it's different than being just a couch potato or a slacker watching a film about slacker. I think the true fans, the really devoted fans of this film, have done as much work as the 45 or 50 academics who contributed essays to this book.
Right, and some of these people just have the phrases memorized, the classic phrases, and they use them in everyday conversation. I'm sure at the convention especially, but of course the most famous being "the dude abides." Mm-hmm. But there's a long list of phrases that the true fans have made part of their lives and part of their language, right?
Right, and I think that's when you know that a film has achieved cult status, is that when it has introduced a kind of code or a communication system into the culture at large.
I guess I should ask you if you're an achiever.
No, I'm not a member of the. I'm not an official member of the Achievers, and I suppose I would have to ask anyone who actually reads the essay to decide whether I've literally achieved anything.
Did you go to the convention in Louisville in 2006 where this idea for the book first came up?
I did not go to the convention, and I'm sorry that I missed it because a number of colleagues and friends of mine did go, and they tried their best, I think, to behave like the true devotees. Some of them are. Judith Roof, the woman I was mentioning before who wrote the essay Size Matters, presented her paper dressed as Walter. So she dressed as John Goodman playing Walter in that film, and apparently was pretty convincing in her delivery of her talk there. So it was not your typical academic convention. And as you might know, it was combined with it took place in a bowling alley,
right.
And it was combined with one of the annual Lebowski Fests. So it was not the usual suspects in tweed, sipping sherry and talking about academic niceties. It was, I think, from what I understand, from what I've heard of the convention, they were really in the thick of the popular celebration, the cult celebration of the film.
Flinging the F word around a lot, I suppose.
I wonder, that's something that can happen in close-knit institutional circles anyway,
that, right.
With or without the Lebowski. But I wonder if that was as liberally used in the academic conference as it is used in the film. It would be a tough standard to meet, to use it that often.
Talking today on Talk of Iowa to Craig Owens, professor of English at Drake University, one of the contributors to the year's work in Lebowski studies based on the fabulous Coen Brothers 1998 movie, The Big Lebowski. And we'll return to the conversation in a minute. Talk of Iowa, Iowa Public Radio. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, The Big Lebowski. Yes, an academic book has finally been written about the famous Coen Brothers 1998 movie. Craig Owens, Drake University professor of English, has one of the essays. Craig, your essay, one of my favorite topics in the movie is the drink, the White Russian, which was the dude's drink. Jeff Bridges playing the dude. And why do you think the Coen Brothers chose the White Russian as his drink?
Well, I've seen enough Coen Brothers films to be wary of reading their minds about what they were intending to do or what their motivations were. But from the perspective of a viewer, I think it was the perfect choice. First, because the White Russian is kind of a precious drink. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with a White Russian, it's a blend of roughly equal parts vodka and Kahlua with the addition of half and half or heavy cream. And sometimes it's served on the rocks, sometimes it's served straight up. But it's a sweet drink, it's easy to drink, and it has a kind of surface patina of sophistication. The word Russian in it suggests that it's somehow exotic. but it's not really a very sophisticated drink, finally. I think of it almost as the poser's drink, you know, somebody who still wants to be sort of in the retro 50s lounge lizard mode well after that era is gone. And the reason that I think it's the perfect drink is because the dude, played by Jeff Bridges in the film, is the anti-poser. If there's one thing he's not, it's a poser. He is upfront and honest about the things he does and the things he likes, and he never pretends to be something other than he is. And so why I think it's an appropriate drink is because of the way, not the drink itself, but because of the way he drinks it.
Mm.
He is so careless about the way he mixes it.
Right. I never saw that in the movie. He is careless, isn't he? If he's visiting somebody, he'll just run to the bar and just kind of slop it together, right?
He makes it with non-dairy creamer at one point.
Ooh.
I think in Maud Lebowski's house. And if you read bartending guides, and I've read a lot of them to prepare this article, and a lot of them are online, they're actually online debates about this, there are all kinds of opinions about whether you should shake it in a shaker over rocks, or whether you should shake it and then pour it over rocks, whether you should use a spoon to separate the cream from the Kahlua so you've got a layered drink, or if it should be mixed together, if the rocks should go in first or last. I mean, all kinds of different ways and all kinds of different opinions about how you make the correct White Russian. And that's another reason why it's a kind of precious poser drink. And that's another reason why it's so refreshing to see the way he drinks it, because he's going to strip any kind of posing potential out of that drink. He's going to drink it just because he likes it, because he likes the taste of it. And it's not because he cares what he looks like when he's drinking it. In fact, he often looks terrible. It gets in his beard and mustache. It looks kind of obscene, the amount of, like, shaken, you know, kind of maybe potentially not quite fresh milk that kind of accrues in his beard over the course of the film.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to imagine. It would have been so simple to put a cheap beer in his hand. You know, or a kind of quintessentially American drink like whiskey, or a drink that we might associate with the Beat Generation of literary slackers, if I can use that term, like sort of cheap, you know, red table wine or something. And so I think the choice of something as precious and falsely sophisticated as the White Russian, in juxtaposition to a character like the dude, was just a really masterful choice on the part of whoever made it, either the Coen brothers or the set designer, decorator, whoever finally decided that this would be his drink of choice. I think it is as natural an extension of the dude as the vodka martini is of James Bond.
Who are some of your favorite characters in the movie?
Well, the movie works in a way that no single character, with perhaps the exception of the dude himself, no single character works alone. And so it's always the interactions among the characters that I think makes any single character an appealing character.
Mm.
As you may recall, there are two Lebowskis in the film. There's the Jeff Bridges character, who's the dude named Jeff Lebowski, and then there is the Big Lebowski, who is also himself a poser, who runs apparently a big financial empire, although it's all just a front. And his assistant, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman,
yeah,
and who is this very punctilious,
yes, indeed,
you know, very precise, kind of a prissy personal assistant, is an excellent character. But the reason he's such an excellent character is not because by himself he would have been some kind of excellent character. It's that interplay between the sort of slacker dude in his jelly shoes and his you know, shaker knit cardigan sweater, standing in this grand foyer next to Philip Seymour Hoffman with his perfectly coiffed hair and his three piece suit, who's trying to explain in the most dulcet, docent tones what these various photographs and plaques and records of achievements are for the Big Lebowski. And so it's always that contrast between two characters in dialogue, I think, that makes the character so appealing. The same goes for Walter, who's John Goodman's character, and who is brash, he's hot-headed, he doesn't think before he acts, He's a loudmouth, he's insulting, and he's self-righteous. And that kind of characteristic, in contrast to, for instance, Donnie, who's played by Steve Buscemi, who's a kind of almost, if there is a Nebbishy character, almost this Nebbish who kind of recedes. He tries to get in on the conversation. He tries to occasionally make a point or be right or be liked. And he's constantly being, you know, beaten down by Walter, even though they're friends. So, no, I cannot pick one favorite, but I can pick favorite pairs. And those would be two of my favorite pairings in the film.
Yeah. It's there's so many odd twists to the plot. The pornographer, Treehorn, and you have the hard to explain this guy.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention how hard to explain the plot twists are. There is a kind of subtle reference to the film The Big Sleep, which was based on the, I believe, Raymond Chandler film, and the screenplay for which was written by the American novelist William Faulkner, and this would have been in the 1930s or 40s, had, of course, Humphrey Bogart as this hard-boiled detective. And rumor has it that by the end of the film, neither the director nor the producer of the film could figure out what had happened in a certain scene, who had shot whom. And so they called Faulkner, and this may be apocryphal, but I think it's still apposite. They called Faulkner, who had written the screenplay, and he didn't know either. And so so as a kind of send-up or satire on those hard-boiled L.A. detective films of the 1940s, it is entirely appropriate that it is impossible to fit every piece of this film together in a clear, linear trajectory, because that scene with Jackie Treehorn, as you mentioned, seems almost random. You know, if they had cut it or severely reduced it, it would have served its narrative function without having confused us as much. But I like it there. I think it's good there.
So is there another book coming out at some point, or will this be it?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, if it's true that if in 10 years a movie that on its surface is so apparently just a light entertainment can produce 50 essays, who knows what could happen in another 50 years? There is kind of a resurgence in Lebowski studies. And, of course, it's all over the Internet. I mean, if you want to find Lebowski studies and, of course, we're using Lebowski studies in quotation marks. It's not really a field called Lebowski studies, but it is in constant ferment on fan websites, discussion boards, chat rooms. I mean, that if you want to, the Lebowski is really the Big Lebowski is really an internet phenomenon more than it is an academic or maybe even filmic phenomenon.
Is there anybody who could have played this role except Jeff Bridges? I just can't myself picture anybody. He's perfect for it.
Yeah, I've thought about that. In fact, one or two people have asked me that question, and I wonder if that's not a retroactive. You know, now that we've seen him as the dude, it's hard to imagine anybody else. But then when you go through the list of actors who you can think of off the top of your head, so you know, who would have been the appropriate age, approaching midlife crises, or thereabouts in the 1990s, it's hard to imagine.
Craig Owens, professor at Drake and contributor to The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. Thanks very much. I enjoyed your essay. It gave me an excuse to watch the film again, which was always great. I appreciate the talk, the conversation. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Dennis. It's been a real pleasure.
The dude abides. We hope he abides, right?
That's right.
Craig Owens is a professor of English at Drake University. His essay, On the White Russian, appears in the new book published by Indiana University Press, The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. Talk of Iowa continues in 5 minutes following the Environment Report. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. There's a group of university professors and researchers around the country who study transportation logistics. Their knowledge is mostly used to help businesses looking for how to do more with less. But some of these transportation researchers are also using their expertise in moving goods efficiently to help areas affected by natural disasters, such as Haiti. One of these people is University of Iowa Professor of Management Studies, Ann Campbell. Campbell started studying disaster logistics after the Indonesian earthquake and tsunami in 2004, and now she's focusing her attention on the Haiti earthquake. Professor Campbell, you're an expert on transportation logistics, and I'm sure once the earthquake happened in Haiti, the tragic earthquake, that was your mind immediately turned to the situation there, thinking how to best proceed, how can authorities best proceed. What are your thoughts on how things have been going so far?
You're right. When I saw the disaster happen, I was really curious, well, you know, one, about the humanitarian aspect, but two, but looking at the logistics side and seeing how it would be different from the tsunami and Hurricane Katrina, to kind of see, have lessons learned from those panned out, and are they going to be able to handle this one better, or are there going to be new lessons to learn, and so forth. And one of the things that was just overwhelming about what happened in Haiti was just how profoundly bad the situation is from a logistics perspective to begin with the destruction of the ports, or the main seaport, the lack of gasoline, the lack of trucks on the island, the lack of major airstrips, and the one that they had having a capacity of, what was it, 30 flights per day, that they were really set up to be sort of a worst-case scenario from a logistics perspective. So it really seemed like even if we learned a lot of lessons from the previous disasters, they're really set up to have a lot of problems sort of almost regardless of the amount of planning and lessons learned, just because of the difficulties and the destruction of infrastructure there.
Is part of it the fact that maybe their infrastructure was lagging in some respects anyway?
Absolutely. I mean, and also the fact you're an island. I mean, that's really going to be a problem to begin with. With Katrina, I mean, we could drive things from across the United States and eventually get it there, where you're on an island and for, you know, at least about 10 days, there's no place for major ships to really pull up and unload supplies. That was a really big difficulty. And they said the roads hadn't been maintained in about 20 years, things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're right. There's absolutely not the infrastructure there to begin with. And the other thing that's key about ports is if you think about a lot of the things that people need early on after a disaster, is food and water, things that are very heavy. So you can't really helicopter in sufficient food and water to feed 3 million people, right? You need things that can really carry heavy, heavy supplies, and particularly anything involved in reconstruction, that kind of equipment and supplies, also very heavy. So you really need ships for that. And so besides the fact you need a place for the ships to pull up, is you need equipment to unload those ships. So one of the big things that every port has is some cranes that are used to remove these big crates or cartons off the ships and put them onto the land. And they talk about the cranes were either broken or submerged. So even if a ship could get there, it had to essentially have its own equipment to get things off. So that's one of the things we're seeing in the news the last few days, is ships showing up now with equipment to be used to unload other ships.
Mm. Have you ever been to Haiti?
No.
Yeah.
Just a very interested bystander from the perspective of, you know, just sort of this is the kind of thing I'm interested in. But I have no, you know, secret knowledge of things in Haiti beyond what the rest of us see, just reading more about those kinds of things.
Do you think that agencies and governments have made some mistakes so far? Do you think that people are doing about as good a job as they can?
I think with anything, a lot of people are doing some things right, and I think there are some things they're going to realize in retrospect may have been able to be done a little bit differently. For example, I think the UN has stepped up to the role of trying to coordinate the different aid organizations. That was one of the lessons learned from the tsunami, is the UN was going to really be in charge of that. But clearly this is was such a scale with so many people involved, it's been sort of overwhelming. So I think they're going to have to learn a little bit better about how to manage the information of who needs what and what organizations can provide what, and get a little bit better at that. I think one of the areas that may be also some possible mistakes maybe was how they handled the airports initially. If you saw, some of the planes that initially landed didn't necessarily contain maybe the first priority things, or they contained things that they didn't have equipment at the airport to unload. So I think that's one thing that, you know, that they worked on and got better at, was managing the airport and making it so that more flights could land and that the right flights could land. But I think maybe initially, maybe because no one was really in charge of it, that maybe wasn't handled the best. But that's one of the reasons why the Haitian government asked the U.S. military to take over the airport, is because they realized they needed someone who could really organize that well.
One thing that I was sort of curious about from the beginning that nobody seemed to discuss is, I mean, what about bringing in material from the Dominican Republic side? I mean, they share the island. Why would that have not worked?
Well, it's actually a little bit more complicated, I think, of a question than you might think. Is they have clearly brought some things from the Dominican Republic. Some ships have arrived and unloaded at the Dominican Republic, and they've brought some things over. But there's some complicated politics there. Apparently, Dominican Republic, even though it shares an island, not necessarily the best friends with Haiti, and maybe not completely making it as easy as they could. Like, there's some issues about the border and allowing people to free flow through the border. They're not really big on that. And also, the roads are not so great. So even though it may seem like the Dominican Republic is really close, but when you're dealing with gravel roads and lots of trucks and equipment and things, those roads are taking quite a few hours to transport. Because they talked about one of the reasons some of the medical teams were slow to get going is because the doctors were arriving in the Dominican Republic and they were having to go get them. And those trips are taking like 6 hours. Just because of the status of the roads and the number of people trying to use the roads. So I think there has been something there, but it wasn't a quick fix solution because they didn't have near the amount of supplies available, maybe not the easiest, greatest infrastructure to get it from there.
Professor Campbell, what you normally do in your day-to-day work is to do research and to teach students on how to make businesses transport their goods more efficiently to make more money, obviously. How did you turn your attention to this whole issue of disaster logistics?
Well, I think it's probably going to be the same reason a lot of people are going to be looking at it now after seeing the reports on Haiti was seeing the news. I mean, right after the tsunami, we saw the kind of reports we're seeing now about these very large delays in getting things to people, the food and the water and these emergency supplies. And I was sitting at home thinking, why are there so many delays just like everyone else? But thinking maybe there's some research to be done here. Maybe there are some underlying questions that maybe research community could work on that could be helpful in that regard. So I started calling different people. I called some people at the Red Cross. I called people from other agencies to get a little bit more perspective about the problems they face and try to identify a few research questions that I could look at with regard to doing some things with regarding the delays. And several other people in my operations community did as well. That's why a lot of people started working on a lot of research projects after Hurricane Katrina. We saw a lot of people start looking at that issue of how to get people evacuated from large metropolitan areas like Houston, Texas, trying to get all those people, if there's a hurricane coming, away, where we had Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita and people stuck on highways for 19 hours. So we had a lot of people in my research community working on sort of things like that. How do you do mass evacuation? So you'll see, I'm sure within the next few months after Haiti, a lot of people at my conferences talking about research problems that have emerged from what we see in the news in Haiti.
So you're not the only expert in transportation logistics in the United States, apparently, because I'd never really heard. I'd never really heard of it as an academic study, but how common is it?
Well, at Iowa, we actually have, at the University of Iowa, we have about three people who look at it specifically within my department. It's actually, you know, a pretty decent-sized field because when you think about the logistics problems for a company the size of Walmart or UPS or Federal Express, and you think about, you know, where should they build their distribution centers and where they should send trucks from place to place, and you try to actually solve that problem, it turns into a very large mathematical problem. So it's not something you and I could, you know, solve by hand. It requires a lot of computing, a lot of thought process, and so it really is kind of a science to it. So because it's the kind of problems that are really important to a lot of companies because it affects their bottom line profoundly. You know, the transportation is a big cost center.
So you're actually using mathematical modeling and very high-powered computing to determine the way to move goods around the country.
Absolutely, yeah. That's why our department got the word science in it because there's a lot to it.
Well, most stuff is still moved by truck in this country, isn't it? So is it just a matter of finding, you know, the best route from or the best way to get from point A to point B? I'm sure it's more complicated than that.
Right, because there's a lot of points A and a lot of points B, right? But you're absolutely right. There is a lot that is moved by a truck in this country.
Well, getting back to the disaster situation in Haiti, one of the points you are making is the lack of supplies made it difficult, very difficult from the beginning. And maybe one solution is to study in advance where to locate supply depots in advance of a storm. Now, this is a new idea, isn't it?
It is a new idea and an old idea because people have, you know, stored up supplies in preparation for bad case scenarios for a long time. But it's a new question, though, in terms of looking at it a little bit more scientifically and a little more strategically. Haiti is going to be a hard one because, you know, you can't really predict earthquakes, right? This was a little unexpected. They can have some supplies stocked up in case of, you know, a variety of disasters. What spawned a lot of my interest in looking at pre-positioning supplies was looking at planning for hurricanes in the United States, because that's something we have just about every year, is at least one hurricane hitting somewhere along, you know, the Gulf or the Atlantic. And so it's not a bad idea to have some supplies in preparation of hurricanes pre-positioned along the coastline. So Haiti, I believe, had some supplies pre-positioned, but of course they had no idea an earthquake would be coming of this scale. But if they had been prepared for hurricanes, which is probably a more realistically or more common thing that would happen there, they could have used those supplies as well. But Haiti's got a lot of poverty, so they've got a lot of struggles in that regard as well.
Would this supply depot idea have been helpful in Hurricane Katrina had there been stock warehouses safely positioned, stockpiled with food and water?
Well, that's one of the things I've spent some time talking to the Red Cross about and thought a lot about, is that is something that the Red Cross already did, was some pre-positioning of supplies, and that's the things that they were able to move in very quickly after Hurricane Katrina. But Hurricane Katrina made them rethink the scale of how much that should be supplied in advance, and a little bit more about where the supplies should be pre-positioned. So now, for example, they store a lot more in advance because they realize that a lot of things like maybe bottled water and MREs are not something that you can necessarily get at a moment's notice. So it's really worth the investment to have quite a bit of the kinds of things that are not going to expire quickly already stored if you can afford to do so, because you can move them so quickly. So even if you have supply depots in South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, and the storm hits in Florida, you can move all these things that have been stored in South Carolina and Louisiana over to Florida quickly because you already own it, you have trucks, and you can get it there quickly because you already own it, and you can move it very quickly.
You described Haiti as being, you know, very challenging from a location standpoint, where the island is located. But when you started studying this whole issue of disaster logistics, you became interested, as you mentioned, in the tsunami back in 2004. And this was an even more remote island, certainly, than Haiti.
But I don't think the poverty was quite as much of an issue as I believe in that location. There were some groups already there, but in terms of accessibility and the port issue, I don't really remember exactly what happened with the ports at that time. What I specifically was looking at in that side was the trucking side there. because that's more my research is in the trucking side, so that's really where I started, was looking at what are some of the difficulties of getting trucks from A to B delivering supplies after the tsunami.
Yeah. Professor Campbell, I'm sure based on what you've learned from the tsunami and watching that situation and Hurricane Katrina and now Haiti, that in your mind, I'm sure you're thinking about the future and how researchers like yourself and many of your colleagues can keep working on some new ideas to help in future disasters. So what are you going to be studying now, or what's changed based on Haiti in some of your research?
Well, that's a great question, because I think it's one that time's going to tell a little bit. I think it's going to take a little bit longer to maybe figure out what are some of those questions that we can study. Clearly, we're going to see that there's a big difference from hurricanes, that are things that are a little bit more predictable than things like earthquakes. I think we're still going to see the importance of pre-planning as much as possible, like prioritizing what supplies are going to go forward, because one of the things that happens in every natural disaster is the communication network gets destroyed. So you're not able to communicate with each other with what we need in different places and communicate very well. So clearly the most that can be planned in advance is going to be still advantageous. I think some of the lessons here may relate to the issue of security. That's one we've seen a lot in the news lately that people were kind of surprised by, is when you're dealing with massive numbers of people and trying to distribute supplies, you know, is there a good way to design the distribution process to keep it from being chaotic and to make it as efficient as possible? I think the fact here, when the ports weren't working and people needed gasoline, I think some people are going to be studying, you know, what would be the best solution in terms of workarounds for that, in terms of, you know, how do we prioritize that? Who needs to get there first to be able to get the port working? I know we did get it working, but could it have been done sooner if there had been a different chain of events? So that's just some of the things that have really piqued my interest so far, but I think it still remains to be seen a little bit of what some of the research topics are going to be.
Should there be an international organization, you know, sort of like FEMA? I mean, I know we have the UN and the Red Cross, but should there be an international organization that exists for the purpose of efficiently and effectively dealing with future disasters?
Well, there is an organization within the UN called OCHA that is has humanitarian affairs in its title, that is technically sort of responsible for that coordination effort. I believe there will always be a lot of talk about how that can be improved and emphasized, and maybe you know, develop special software or hire more logistics people. That's one of the challenges, is a lot of aid organizations don't tend to have logistics people working at them, but clearly that's a big part of having an effective process. So I think it won't be surprising if we see even more attention drawn to the UN's responsibility in that effort. In the United States, we have an organization through the government called USAID or USAID, and they're involved in the coordination. You may see a little more emphasis on them, maybe trying to take a bigger role when we have large disasters in terms of the coordination effort, but I clearly think that's something we're going to see going forward, is those organizations maybe hiring more logistics people or developing more technology to get better at that. But I would be very surprised if we would see a new group or a new organization emerging, but more restructuring or encouraging more development of these existing organizations.
You were quoted, Professor Campbell, in one newspaper saying that disasters are different than just normal transportation procedures. It's about, and you say it's about getting there fast and fairly. Fairly in the sense that you cover all areas, not just those easily accessible. So what you're saying here is that, you know, you can't ignore remote areas. You can't ignore smaller towns and villages. You have to think about everybody affected.
Absolutely. I think that was, for me, when I started thinking about disasters, what I started was by thinking about how are the problems in a disaster from a logistics perspective different than in a commercial business. So if you think about how does Walmart distribute their products, how would it look different in a disaster? And so one of the things I was thinking about was, well, one is the time frame. We have to develop this supply chain of delivery overnight. You have very poor communication. Like we said, the communication infrastructure may be destroyed. You may have bad infrastructure like roads or ports destroyed, things like that. But just your objectives are different. You don't want to just deliver food and water to a particular town because it's most convenient to the airport. That may be of minimum cost, but it's not necessarily the best in terms of service. So you got to think about fairness. And you also really have to think about speed. I mean, when you think about the longer it takes supplies to get to people affects their likelihood of survival, really speed becomes sort of a primary objective. And it really can change a little bit about, you know, the design of your delivery network.
Professor Ann Campbell, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome.
Ann Campbell is professor of management sciences at the University of Iowa. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.